Sometimes I wonder, is God still there? And that's when somebody comes along and says, be ye not weary in well-doing. You will reap in due season if you faint not. And somebody tells me, I say, oh, really? And then my faith gets stronger. My faith and my hope gets stronger because I have interacted in my community.
Welcome to In Good Faith. This is the first of a mini-series in the city of Atlanta, where there is a storied history of interfaith relations. I'm with producer Heather Bigley, and we met so many people with so much history.
I know. We had the chance to fly out to Atlanta for their Interfaith Fall Fest, and we met tons of people there. But we also were able to set up all kinds of interviews with folks who historically have led Atlanta in its work of interfaith and interethnic relations.
Next week, we'll hear from Rabbi Ellen Nemhauser, who I spoke with in a synagogue, and the interfaith musical duo Lapidus and Miles, some really great music, great guys to speak with, as well as a discussion with Angela Rice, the director of Interfaith Community Initiatives. And we'll end with a book club episode at the end of January, a discussion of Dr. King's well-known letter from a Birmingham jail. We start off with Reverend Gerald Durley, who we met at his church and got to speak to in his office.
He was great. He was a student leader in the American Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s. He's going to refer to himself as merely a foot soldier. Among other things, he served in the U.S. Peace Corps in Nigeria. In Switzerland, he was able to do a postgraduate degree. He earned a Master of Divinity from Howard University, and he served for 25 years as a pastor for Providence Missionary Baptist Church, which, as you said, Steve, is where we were able to do this interview. And the walls were bedecked. Can we say bedecked? Bedecked with pictures of him with every sort of major political leader of the last 40 years. It was pretty astonishing.
And one thing that is going to come out, I called him strong, or how do you stay strong at one point, and he said, oh, I'm not strong, but I'm resilient. I keep getting up.
So we're going to get right into this interview with Reverend Dr. Gerald Durley, where he actually talks about meeting racism for the first time in the South as an 18-year-old young man.
I was born there in Wichita. My father was a minister in the Church of Christ at that time. And we moved from all around. That's why I was so many cities, because he moved from church to church. And so we did have a strong faith base there in the home all the way through, coming through junior high school until we moved to Denver, Colorado. So it was always around faith, strong faith, breaking down barriers. I was not so much involved in the civil rights movement, because I think many black people that are raised on the West Coast and the Midwest where I was born, we didn't see the kind of same contentious nature that was in Alabama and Mississippi.
Yeah. I read when you arrived in Tennessee that you got on a bus and you
That was my senior year. That my senior year was 1959, 1960. And I had won, we had just won the state championship in Denver, Colorado. And Johnny McLendon said, have you ever considered going south to play basketball? Tennessee State was an emerging powerhouse. They had just won for the first time in the history of the United States three NAIA awards. And I said, no, I'm gonna go to UCLA or I'm gonna go to University of Colorado. But I said, I'll at least go down in August to see what it's like. So I got on a bus going to Tennessee State. And when we got to the Tennessee State line, the bus driver came back and grabbed me and said, you've got to go to the back of the bus. And I thought that he was saying I should go to the back of the bus because maybe it's more room back there. I was 6 feet, 4 and a half. So I said, fine. And then he said, no, you people can't ride above that line. And I said, what do you mean, you people? Obviously, he did not know. I was from Denver. I call myself the double D. Mm-hmm. The double defensive, delectable, darling, dynamic, dangerous, devastating D from Denver was my little handle. Rapping is nothing new. So I would do that. And so he said, you got to go. And I said, wait a minute, you can't put me back there. So the bus driver grabbed me, but two black women came and said, young man, you're going to get yourself killed. Come on back here with us. And I was sitting there, and then the coach came and said, come on, you're going to get in trouble. Let's get to the campus. He came in and took me on to the campus. And I sit there, and I said, this is unbelievable. But again, my goal in life was to play 4 years and then going into the pros, play ball. But that was 1960, the 60 Olympics. Wilma Rudolph had just won 4 gold medals. The girls' track team, as a young man, came from Louisville, Kentucky, my same age, named Cassius Clay. He came in. So we're all 18 years old. Ralph Boston broke long jump record. And I'm looking at all of these gold medals on at the student union table. But then I'm thinking about all that had happened, how people were so afraid and fearful that they would attack someone that they didn't know. So Later that week, I went down to Fisk University, which is close to Nashville. They said that there were going to be some men coming in talking to us about the situation in Nashville and throughout the South. So my roommate and I, one was 6'9", the other was 6'8", and myself, we said, let's go down to Fisk University to hear what they're talking about. And Fisk was known for having some of the most beautiful, intelligent women in the country. So we went down to see the intelligence, and we were there looking at all of the wonderful, brilliant ladies there at Fisk University. And then the door opened, and five men walked in. One of them's name was Hosea Williams. One of them's name was Andy Young. One was John Lewis. And then here was this other guy, Martin Luther King, walking in, and we're saying, it's going to get serious in here. They start talking about the disparaging nature at the bus station, non-voting rights, and we're going to put together something here in Nashville. We're going to a lunch counter, and we're going downtown. And this is all so new to me and to some of the others.
Right.
And Coach told us, don't get involved with all of this civil rights stuff. You came here to play basketball, we're going to get an education, and you go on. And many of our parents told us, don't get involved with this movement. You get an education, get a job, get married, take care of our kids, and worship the Lord. God was at the heart of all of this. But they flipped the script on us and said that when you talk about civil rights and human rights and following what God wants you to do in your life and love your neighbor as you love yourself, that's liberal. So we said, wait a minute, are we going to step out there? So we began to step out. And I guess, Steve, that would be my bottom line as to how I got into this at 18 years of age into where I am today.
You're still going at 82.
Yeah.
You haven't stopped your activism. And I wonder if I could ask, because you became a reverend, Dr. King was as well, and you mentioned Ralph Abernathy.
Hosea Williams.
Yeah.
John Lewis.
So.
Jesse Jackson.
This is all tied to faith.
Faith.
And I just want to ask, what is it about the faith of you and these others that called them to do this?
One of the things that you learn in New Testament teaching when you go to Hebrews, faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. So faith means you hope, you hang on in there until pain ends. Hope. We would even say if you're going down to march today and you cannot face nonviolence, you can't go down there with us today, because we've got to demonstrate that through peace and through love and understanding in a nonviolent way. Now, Dr. King learned nonviolence from Gandhi when he went over and spoke to Gandhi. But we, many of us students, we were not nonviolent. I was not nonviolent. I was a ball player. And if you're going to come at me, I'm going to come at you. If you're going to spit on me, I'm going to spit at you. But we had to understand and sublimate that. Jesse Jackson was a great quarterback and football player. Mm-hmm. We understood competition, but we began to understand in order to accomplish your goal, you've got to sublimate your own individual desires. Mm-hmm. And how do you do that? By having a faith that if you stay the course and believe that God can make a difference in your life, that God is at the essence of your life, that God will give you the intestinal fortitude to keep on pushing, then you do it. You keep going. And that's what the faith is about, that whether you get locked up or whether you get beaten, God will see you through.
Amen.
Yeah.
So you've never stopped, but some of the civil rights issues that we're aware of have changed. And I'm really fascinated because of your generation that you're talking about climate change.
Yeah.
How that ties in with civil rights.
Yes.
Will you talk to me about that?
Well, it's interesting. After all of these years, about 14 years ago, I had no idea. Climate change was so far removed from me. Uh-huh. I'm dealing with police brutality. I'm dealing with teenage pregnancy. I'm dealing with the crime in the area. But I met a young lady. She began to talk about the climate. She began to talk about carbon dioxide in the air. And then I began to see that those in the communities whom we're called to serve, who we're talking about the salvation, who we're talking about life, that they were suffering more from climatic conditionings and they polluted the least. So this young lady began to talk to me, and I said that it's a constitutional right to vote. It's a constitutional right to, if you've earned some money, to live in a certain neighborhood. Those are constitutional rights. But there's also a constitutional right for clean energy, for clean air, for clean water, a constitutional right not to destroy what God said in Genesis 1:26. This is the earth. It is perfectly balanced. But we came along, even before we reached the Industrial Revolution, and we began to treat God's perfectly balanced earth that he gave us like a rental car. So I said, well, you know, in the civil rights movement, we were doing that. We were fighting for constitutional rights. So therefore, we can take the same energy, the same ideas, the same philosophy to apply to the environmental movement. That lady's name was Jane Fonda. Jane and I talked, and she said, I want you to meet my husband at that time here in Atlanta. So I met Ted Turner. And so I began to meet other people in this, and it became clear that this is a environmental movement, which is almost like the civil rights movement, because people are fighting not just the voting rights now, but survival rights. And we're seeing that now because we're destroying this perfectly balanced world that God gave to us. Hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, all of this, the oceans are flooding. All of these things are real. But again, if we don't believe and trust and have faith in God, the same destruction will occur again. Mentally, physically, emotionally, we all must work together. When a ship goes down, we've all got to work together to either try to get on land again or something. That's what keeps me going and keeps me excited to how to use the power of what God put in our life for the humanity. See, it's one thing for people to go to Exodus in the book and talk about the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not. But what about the first commandment? Take care of my earth. So I'm just going back to the first commandment.
Yeah, be stewards.
Be stewards.
Be responsible.
Be responsible. That's right.
And often the people who have the least power are the people who are suffering the results, as you just said.
They do not have the financial resources. Yeah. They do not have the political clout to change things around in terms of their own lives and their own livelihoods, because the powers that be, when a large company comes in and they've decided to put waste dumps in your neighborhood rather than put them in suburban areas or other areas.
Reverend Turley, you're not afraid to speak up. Or maybe you are afraid, but you do it anyway.
Yeah, anyway.
But you speak up. You do speak up.
Well, the two words that made us strong in the civil rights movement, I live with them now. Two words. Mm-hmm. When you talk about how do you stay going, two words were strong. And I tell all these young people, two words, what are you willing to sacrifice and what are you willing to risk? Mm. I was willing to risk a 4-year college education, a basketball scholarship. I was willing to go down there and stand. When we organized all the students in 1963, I was SGA president to go to the March on Washington. And when I came back, of course, I caught it, you know, because I was going against the prevailing entities of that time. But what are you willing to sacrifice and what are you willing to risk? When you're willing to sacrifice and you're willing to risk to speak truth to power.
Tell me about that march. What was that like?
We knew that this was very important. We knew that the bills had to be passed. We knew that President Kennedy had said he didn't want that march to occur because it would be so disruptive in the city. But then you looked up and you saw grandfathers and people coming from all over, and you knew you had to be there. Then you found Harry Belafonte and Frank Sinatra, that group coming in, and you saw, and you were there sitting on all of that water, and it was hot, and you heard people speaking one after another. You knew you just had to be there. Sometimes in your life, you've got to understand that in order for justice and equality and honesty and decency to occur, you've got to be willing to sacrifice. You might not know the end. You might not know exactly why you're there, but there's something called the unctioning of the Holy Spirit that moves you to speak.
You mentioned Representative John Lewis. Tell me about working with him. What was the relationship?
I met John. I was 18. John was 20. And Andy Young was 28. I think now, up until John's passing, he stayed the course. And what kept him going was a belief that America could live up to its moral, ethical, constitutional rights. And he was willing to sacrifice.
He did.
He was willing to risk.
And he paid for it.
He paid for it. But that was an ancient character in time who was willing to sacrifice, who was willing to speak. Some people say, oh, well, that guy, he was crucified. I think he was assassinated because he was truthful to his belief for all people. And he was assassinated for it. Jesus was assassinated because he stood up and spoke to the scribes, the Pharisees. And so John Lewis and those in the movement were doing that. And even now, I'm still a foot soldier trying to speak to the kinds of things and raise the issues.
The foot soldier who is still marching.
When you're very honest about it, it's about faith. Mm-hmm. It's about believing that it will happen if you maintain the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. So now we're seeing that faith action now beginning to take place, and it's going in, it's like a wave. And are you there in the right time, at the right reason, for the right purpose, for the right mission? And are you the right person? It's all coming together. And God is moving in such a powerful way, and truth is coming out. Truth that is crushed will eventually rise.
I wonder if I could talk community for a minute.
Okay.
We can worship on our own, We have our own personal faith. But there's something that we get when we meet in communities, like when you're the reverend or a pastor for a congregation. What can happen there to build people? Why is that important that we meet together and that we have those local communities?
Here's how I respond to that. I think the real strength in our coming together was a five-letter word, but it wasn't faith. It was T-O-U-C-H, the touch. Mm. The touch is what made us stronger, and when we touch, our faith is increased. When we would come together as a unit, as a congregation, as a worship experience, you had the older lady say, baby, here's a little piece of chewing gum. Now, don't tell your mama where you got it from, and don't chew out loud. Or a little piece of peppermint. Or a little boy, they say, come here, young man, don't be running all over this building. Sit down. We're teaching discipline, the touch. Mm-hmm. Or the preacher would get up and tell the lie about I'm just about through, and they'd say, he ain't through. He's going to keep on preaching. But it was a touch, and everybody knew it. And so that was a camaraderie that reinforced each other. But when we went into COVID, and we went into virtual worship, and when I'm preaching now, I said, I'm glad to see you all who are virtually worshiping with us, but there's something when you come down here, and there's a magic in the touch.
Yeah.
The touch has kept us together. When all the apostles came together, they had a touch. They were all different, but it was a touch. Suppose they had been virtual, they wouldn't have been able to see what Peter was doing and what John was doing. But they touched each other and they became stronger. Jesus, when he came from the mountain, he said, you all are down here sleeping, but he had to wake them up by the touch. Mm. And I think that's what the worship experience is about. I mean, I couldn't stand the worship service. My daddy was the preacher, and the songs went too long. The announcements were too long. The sitting there with the little shirt, the little this. I wanted to be out running and having fun. But it's something that we've got to do, and that's where the church comes in. Well, that's where it comes in when the power and the faith of God says, I will not do that. I will not despair you. I will not discourage you. I will stay strong in the faith. But sometimes my faith gets a little weak. Sometimes I wonder, is God still there? And that's when somebody comes along and says, be ye not weary in well-doing. You will reap in due season if you faint not. And somebody tells me, I say, oh, really? And then my faith gets stronger. My faith and my hope gets stronger because I have interacted in my community. But our own selfish, egomaniacal, greedy positions predicated upon fear has divided us. When we can come back to say that we're all a human nature under divine will of a God, I have so much respect for the Buddhists and the Jews. And when we talk about what the Jews had gone through during the Holocaust, when I can understand what Buddha talked about suffering, then I begin to see the commonality. I'm not afraid to say what Allah has done. I call it Jehovah Jireh. I call it God, but Allah has done something. I don't get into an argument because the Buddhists say that they're on their way to paradise, and I'm talking about on the way to heaven. Their paradise might be my heaven. My heaven might be their paradise. But it keeps them to be grounded in a God, in a divine entity that keeps them together. I don't get into it because different people have different ways of finding, but they're finding that what they believe in strengthens them, that gives them the abilities to sustain themselves. And so I think our strength comes when we begin to appreciate our differences and show that there's much more a commonality than we have in our differences. For 9 years, we went and did the Shabbat service at Temple Sinai in Sandy Springs. We went over there, and you're talking about something beautiful when you see our choir singing and the cantor from the Jewish faith singing, Go Down Moses. It just shows you. Or the other night, right here in Atlanta, Georgia, oh, man, it was a beautiful experience when the Mormon Tabernacle Choir sang with Spelman College and Morehouse College, and we were all there together. And then afterwards, the camaraderie that was there, maybe we experienced something very briefly on earth that God had created. Mm.
And doing it musically didn't hurt.
The orchestra was there. And then to see outside of the Martin Luther King Chapel, 12 buses with about 2,100 people there.
Reverend Durley, it made me smile to read that you were in a singing quartet as a young man. Do you have a favorite hymn?
Great is thy faithfulness. Oh, Lord, my Father, thou changest not, thy compassion to hear. Great is thy faithfulness, O Lord, my Father, thou changest not, thy compassion that needs. Because there needs to be something in all of our lives that keeps us grounded. Mm-hmm. And whenever I say, thou changest not, thy compassion, they fail not. Thou compassion. And there are certain things, even now, you've gone through ups and downs. You've gone through some things that were disappointing, some things that hurt, yet you remain faithful to a God. Mm-hmm. You held on to it. And people will say that you're strong. I mean, my son, his wife died at 44 of cancer. Then right after that, her father died. So I did my daughter-in-law's funeral, then my son's father-in-law. Then right after that, my wife died. Mm. And then a year later, my son died at 47. And people will say, Dr. Dudley, you're so strong. And I have to remind her, I am not strong. I'm resilient. I'm going to keep getting up. And I think that that's where you believe in an almighty, merciful, sovereign God that says, I will not leave you nor forsake you. Then we sing the song, Hold to God's Unchanging Hand. Mm. Time is filled with swift transition, not on earth and who can stand. Build your hopes on things eternal. Hold to God's unchanging hand. There's another song that we sing in the church called I Am on the Battlefield. And everybody sings, I am on the battlefield for my Lord. And everybody, oh, I am. And the whole place is going. And in recent days, after all I've been through, I'm saying now, I like the song. I've sung it many times. I'm on the battlefield. But now, I think God is looking for some people who are not just on the battlefield, but some who are in the battle. I know people that have been on the battlefield and they don't have a scratch on them because they're not close to the battle. In order for us to succeed now and move ahead and do what God called us to do and be, we've got to be in the battle. Can you be in a battle and never have a scratch? When you in this journey, you are in the battlefield. So now when I conclude a sermon, I say, don't sing I'm on the battlefield, sing I'm in the battle. Any of y'all that's been in the battle, somebody get up if you've been in the battle. If you had heartache with your child, with your wife, with your friend, on your job, you thought you should have had the job, but it didn't come your way. You've been in the battle. We can talk. And how do you get through the battle? First of all, you got to get up and put on the helmet of salvation, the breastplate, as it says. Get ready in Ephesians. Put it on because you're going to face it. When I leave here, I'll be in a battle. I just don't know the battle, but I do know who's in charge. I do know the general who will lead me through the battle and land me safely to victory.
Many thanks to Reverend Gerald Durley for speaking with us. And special thanks to Stephanie Merling for her work on our behalf in our Atlanta Interfaith miniseries. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Ebert, Katarina Martinich, and James Sturdivant. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Ashton Parkinson, and Lauren Sandberg. Spread the word about In Good Faith by leaving a comment and subscribing to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. We think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. Our YouTube page is youtube.com/@in-good-faith. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join us again soon, right here in Good Faith. Hi, I'm Stephen Cap Perry, host of In Good Faith. Nothing captivates me more than people setting out on an adventure, especially if it's a place I wish I could go to or a subject I wish I knew more about, but I don't live in the right place or I don't have the equipment or the expertise. I'm telling you about a podcast from our BYU Radio family of podcasts, an award-winning podcast called Constant Wonder. With host Marcus Smith, you'll be expanding your horizons on all kinds of discovery. It could be science, it could be art, history, and more. Do you need that feeling of awe and wonder in your life more? I do, and I love it when I see how to experience that by hearing the stories of people who are doing and exploring all of those things that are so interesting to me. Check out the podcast, Constant Wonder.